Welcome to How We Built Our Team. I'm your host, Katie Culver. If you're building startup teams, this podcast is for you. We interview founders and hiring leaders to uncover their strategies for building and scaling world-class teams. From attracting and evaluating top talent to creating a strong company culture, our guests share their insights and experiences on what it takes to build your dream team. We are so excited to welcome Dave Carhart to the podcast today. Dave is a fractional HR executive and HR tech advisor. He previously led the people teams at Lattice as they scaled 5x and at Branch Metrics as they scaled 3x. So he's led people partners and compensation at MuleSoft through their IPO and acquisition by Salesforce for 20x, the ARR. And before moving into the startup world, he spent several years at HP, which was over 300,000 employees at the time. And he brings experience from M&A, workforce planning, and talent strategy in the APAC region. So, Dave, thank you so much for being here. You have such a range of experience in the people space. So I can't wait to dive in today.
Yeah. Thanks, Katie. I love these conversations. So excited to get into it.
Awesome. Before we jump straight into my questions, I'd love to start with, you know, you. Why do you work in the people space?
Yeah. You know, I started out as a recruiter. I didn't intend to get into recruiting, but it was after college. I didn't know what I wanted to do. I applied to a bunch of different jobs and I'd applied to one and the person reached out. They said, well, you're not a good fit for this job, but we're a recruiting firm. We think you'd be a good recruiter. We want to talk to you about that. And so I wound up as a recruiter and I started working with all of these different HR folks and companies. And it just amazed me what I saw. I saw just how much companies were missing opportunities to really get the most value out of all the investments they were making in their people. I saw how little strategy and forethought companies had in their hiring approach, just sort of flying all over the place. And I was, oh my goodness, like, there's so much more that companies could be doing that would be really valuable for their business, for their people. And I think there's a real opportunity there. And so that was what set me off on getting into the world of HR and people teams.
Awesome. Yeah. I mean, I think a lot of people ends up that way, kind of accidentally starting out and then you just continue and end up learning more and more about the space. So let's start with the basics here for folks. What is people strategy and why is it important?
Yeah, so I think of people strategy just simply as how do you proactively deliver on your overall business strategy? And it's getting the right people on the bus, it's getting them working towards common goals, and it's organizing them in a way so that they can really deliver superior performance. And, you know, all the little programs that we talk about and different tactics, at the end of the day, it all comes down to how are you executing on and delivering your overall business strategy. And so I think when you don't do that, when you don't proactively approach those elements in a strategic way, you wind up down the line with challenges in the business. And that can be because maybe you wind up with challenges hiring or problems with attrition or employee motivation or, you know, misaligned incentives or misspent compensation dollars, right? There's a lot of different things that can go wrong. But when those things go wrong, it shows up ultimately in the business results.
What is the worst outcome or like an example of a kind of poor outcome that you've seen when a company doesn't invest in this? Like, what is the cost to not investing in your people strategy?
Yeah. So I think about my time at MuleSoft, when I first came in, there'd been very little investment in the people function. It was about 700 people. And right after I came in, there was me and I two folks on my team, and we were the entirety of non-recruiting HR. The recruiting team was massive, but we were a very, very small little team, way underinvested. And so there was a lot that you would expect a 700 person company to have: levels, compensation bands, an equity program, like basic manager training, like all those things just didn't exist. And there were results from that. We would do the engagement survey and just a constant refrain of, I don't understand what the opportunities for growth are here. And just a lot of kind of folks feeling upset about that. A lot of folks that were first-time managers that were just really struggling. And you could see then that their teams were struggling because of it. And you know, you could see then the follow-on effects with each of those groups. You know, the first-time manager who didn't have any support, you know, that engineering team, that was also the one that was having troubleshooting code. And you could also see that as we started to invest in those things, how those teams could turn it around.
Yeah, so essentially, I guess we can talk a little bit more about your experience at MuleSoft. And when you joined, it seems like there was really nothing from a people perspective. How do you come in and prioritize across all those things that you didn't have yet? Do you have any recommendations around that? Obviously, you were using surveys and things, but curious to hear.
Yeah, I think that it was probably one of the mistakes that I did make at MuleSoft coming in. It was my first time in a startup environment. And early on, especially during like the first year, I didn't prioritize enough. And I think, you know, I just tried to go and solve everything. I learned that over time. And I think it was one of the things that helped me then in future roles as I took on head of HR roles. I think, you know, the things that I look at, I really try and ground myself in the data. And that's engagement surveys, that's attrition data, that's, you know, demographics and, you know, hiring plans and numbers. That's a really big component, because when it comes to people and culture, there's a lot of just impressions that can float around and anecdotes, and people try and manage by anecdote and can go off in really, really wrong directions. So that's one. I would say on the specifics, when I've gone into at least a high growth startup situation, the things that I'm looking at first are compensation structure, especially when you're trying to hire a lot, onboarding, both like the process and the experience, because you need to get folks just integrated into the culture and ramped in productivity, and core manager training and expectations. And then the final one is goals and performance. And the specifics of that, you know, some companies are all in on OKRs, some companies do, you know, our rating structures are not, right? There's like so many different variations, but it's really critical that you have an approach that the company is organized around to really assess and act on performance and talent and how employees are doing in their roles.
Yeah, that's super helpful to break down. Obviously, when you came into MuleSoft, there were, you said, 700 people, which is quite a lot to manage. And you're probably having to influence people across the organization. What does that look like, you know, as a maybe new HR person or people person to a company? How do you provide that influence that's needed to get all those things stood up and the buy-in across the organization? Was there any like challenges that you ran into with that?
Yeah, I mean, definitely it's something that becomes more and more complex as organizations get larger. I think a lot of the principles are the same. It starts with, what is your relationship as an HR leader with the CEO, the founder, the senior executive team? And then particularly with a larger organization, a lot of it comes down to HR business partners, right? So you need to find ways to scale those relationships and that influence. And in a modern people organization, the way you really do that is through effective HR business partners. So it's always a part of the team, a function that I really, really invest in, because that winds up being the face of HR, the person who is, you know, working in and helping folks navigate all that. You can have whatever policies and programs that you want, but at the end of the day, so much is gray area and helping people understand and deal with nuance. And the HR business partners are the folks that are really doing that day in and day out, and helping guide the organization.
Yeah, that's super helpful. When I worked at Accenture, you know, massive company, I remember like the only really thing I knew about HR was the HRBPs that we had for our groups and how much they represented HR to the rest of the company. I'm curious, you know, as MuleSoft grew and you were there to help kind of lead the team through that Salesforce acquisition and IPO, what changed with the people strategy at that time as you're kind of preparing for that huge major change in the trajectory of the company? Can you share a little bit more about that?
Yeah. So in the lead up to the IPO, there were a couple of big areas that we focused on. One was really the prep itself. So directly around, okay, there's a set of kind of compliance requirements and, you know, okay, we're going to go work on our SOX audits and like, you know, all of those, direct prep elements. I'd say that related to that, it's just, but less about compliance and more about process and culture, really upping the level of rigor. So there's just expectations for a public company in terms of its predictability on revenue and expenses and cash flow and all of the financial elements. So we started driving a lot more rigor in, say, headcount planning and management that we didn't need to have before when we were just operating as a private company. The third area was more about culture and about how people understood what was happening. I think we were very cognizant of the risk that folks would see the IPO as an endpoint. And the mantra that we had internally is that the I in IPO stands for initial, that it's not the end of the road, it's a marker, but it's really a beginning marker to us entering a much bigger game with more established players, with higher expectations, with, you know, much higher accountability, much faster accountability from public markets if things go wrong, and a lot of scrutiny. And so, you know, that sort of cultural like mindset shift was something that we really tried to communicate a lot about and make sure that folks were planning for what would it take to continue to up our game, that we needed to keep working on that rather than taking our foot off the gas at any point.
Yeah, that's super interesting. I like that I is just the initial. So I think for a lot of folks in the startup world, it's kind of like, you know, you invest early, you get your equity, and that's kind of the big outcome is the IPO or the acquisition in some way. So
yeah,
it's interesting to hear how you thought about that. When you worked at Branch Metrics, I think going back a little bit further, there you kind of came in much earlier than when you started at MuleSoft. You scaled the headcount from like 150 to about 400 folks as the head of people and took on that kind of full ownership of the people org. Can you talk a little bit more about that growth and what do you feel was the biggest driving factor behind that success?
Yeah. One of the things that was really interesting and unique about Branch was it had four co-founders. And I think, you know, I had heard and had heard people talk about how important co-founder dynamics were, and I really saw it in action. I think it was one of the really special things about the company. I think that the co-founders had not just a good relationship with each other, but I think a really interesting set of like complementing and offsetting skill sets that I think that you could see it reflected in the culture too. I think it made for a really dynamic culture that was able to draw on a lot of different strengths. I think there was one of the co-founders who also had a background in engineering, like operations and manufacturing engineering. It was the first person that I had worked with in the startup world who really had a mindset for operational rigor. I had worked with a lot of startup folks who you know, it was all see your pants and, you know, kind of running around on fire. And there's like something great to that, right? Like the energy and the sense of urgency. But I think working there, I saw the power that really like well-run and executed operations can bring. And when we were working on whether it was a project or, you know, a new initiative or go-to-market initiative, right? There was just, there was a level of organization and expectations and I think accountability that I just had not seen in a startup space before. And I think that just brought a huge amount to, I think, to what we all brought to the company.
Yeah, that's interesting. I do think a lot of those approaches tend to be very, very founder driven. So if you have someone who cares about the vision, but isn't quite so operationally rigorous, that kind of ends up happening across the company. And if you have that from the beginning, then it sets the precedent or the standard. How did that impact, you know, your recruiting and people function in terms of driving that operational rigor as you're running recruiting processes, which I know from experience doesn't always get that kind of leadership buy-in to run a really tight process and track those metrics back to the business outcomes?
Yeah. So it was huge for recruiting, right? You know, there's obviously some places in the like the HR business partnering where like it just, you know, maybe there was a little bit more tension, but in recruiting, it was wonderful. So, I mean, the things we would do, there was a lot of like defining and documentation of process and then metrics around that. And so, you know, we were looking in the ATS, you know, we had sort of all of our reports set up and looking at on a really regular basis, all of the metrics, not only about, hey, did we hit our hiring goal for the quarter, but what are all the process metrics, right? Like, you know, down to scheduling time, right? And like touch time between candidates and, you know, where in the process was everyone when dropping off. And it was not just something that, you know, just a recruiting coordinator was looking at, but the head of recruiting was looking at, I was looking at the heads of departments when they were in a big hiring sprint, they would be digging into. And so I think, you know, that overall idea of, all right, look, we're going to sit down, we're going to define a process, and then we're really going to drive to that, particularly in a, when you're going through such volume. And I think, you know, at one point we were up to like pre-COVID, you know, we were hiring anywhere between, you know, around like 50, 75, 80 people a quarter, which, you know, for that size organization was just like incredibly fast.
Yeah, that's awesome that you guys really invested in building out those metrics and reporting. Not just the big picture, but those detailed touch points really do matter and they impact the candidates as well. That's something that we're kind of working on is helping people get better access to their data. I'm curious, you mentioned ATS. I know you've worked in a lot of different companies in recruiting. I'm curious if you have a perspective on, you know, your favorite ATS. Mm. We're currently building one at Dover and we're launching it next week. So I'm very curious about that.
I'm excited to see it. I've been in Greenhouse, Lever, Workday, a few others that were from like the early 2000s, you know, so quite a few. I mean, there's a couple of them that I like. I mean, I think definitely the big thing for me that as a head of HR has been, okay, how easily am I able to like see on like a real-time basis, the core metrics that I care about, how easily are we able to share those with, you know, my peers and the exec team? So, I mean, like that's a really, really big piece for me. And like, I think what it's come down to when I've liked or disliked an ATS.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense, especially in the position as like head of people and you're kind of overseeing everything. A lot of the issue that we see around ATS, I'm just curious to, I guess, go into this a little deeper, is around the data being wrong. So then if your candidate data is wrong, then obviously none of that really matters, which is really difficult to keep all of that super up to date. How is that kind of accountability work in the roles that you've been in?
Yeah.
Who's responsible for it?
So you always have to start by asking why, right? Like I think whether it's an ATS or an HRIS or someone sees a data point, whether, and maybe it's a department leader and someone says, all right, that data point's wrong. That's not what it is. But the question is why, right? The data can be wrong for a lot of different reasons. Is there a good repeatable process that produced that, right? Is the data, is there a way that it's being audited? Sometimes I find that it's wrong just because people have different understandings or definitions. I mean, I see this all the time when it comes to just headcount. You have an HR team and a finance team both produce a headcount report at the end of the quarter. And the first time you do it, you'll always find that it's always wrong, or at least they don't agree with each other. And you dig in and you find out, oh, okay, well, we're accounting for people on leave differently, or we're defining whether, whether interns are or not, or, this type of employee, or how we categorize internal movements, right? Like all these like definitional issues that I think, can be resolved, but it's not necessarily like a tool or a process issue, but you need to get folks on the same page about just what the data is supposed to mean and what you're solving for.
Yeah, that makes sense. When as the company scales, obviously people are kind of doing things on their own, and then when you put it together, it doesn't always match up exactly the same. I've definitely been there in some of my roles before. I'm curious, as you think about headcount planning, obviously you've worked at various stage startups, and we have always encouraged companies to do this as early as possible.
Yeah.
Like you're kind of headcount planning and looking at which people do you need to build out X product on your roadmap, something that you should be thinking ahead, but many, many, many startups are like, we need this person yesterday, so we're going to start hiring them today. And they don't really have that, budget approval in advance and all those things.
Yeah.
Any advice or thoughts around when headcount planning should really become a serious, action and task that kind of pairs with your quarterly or business planning?
Yeah. Very early in a company's life cycle. I mean, really from the very beginning, a company is by necessity doing some type of headcount planning, right? Like they're at least looking at, all right, how many dollars and how many people. It just may not be very sophisticated, and it may not be very accurate. So the question is then, all right, you're already doing something for the stage of growth, for the infrastructure that you have, for the money that you have. How accurate and how long of a time horizon do you need? And the answer is usually that the people should have more accuracy and a longer time horizon than they're already at. I think for most companies, there's more that they can and should be doing to add some sophistication to that process. I think one of the things that I find really helpful is backing into the open dates. I would do this actually right around like now. So sometime in the second half of the year, I'd go to like the sales leader, and because I know that they're going to put down X number of reps, right, that are going to be quote unquote Q1 hires, and by which they mean, okay, actually, maybe either that person's like starting on January 1st and then that's baked into all of their revenue numbers, or maybe even like off ramp on January 1st. And then you start looking back and you say, okay, well, X number of weeks before that from sign to start, what's our average time to fill? Okay, well, beyond the average time to fill, what do we fill? What's the 80% time, right? So like, when would we have to start this role, hiring on this role, in order to be 80% confident of hitting the date that this person wants? The dates that recs have to open start backing up into October, September, August, depending on what the role is. And I think, when people see that data, some of them start to take a different view of, okay, we need to be thinking like much further forward as business leaders than maybe we are right now. The thing that I would pair with that, there's a risk in headcount planning of becoming incredibly precise, but not very accurate. right? You can go out to, you know, a year from now, you know, the exact headcount, but you have to account for, well, how much, like different scenarios, how much upside, how much downside, in the same way that finance teams will do. And so you have to allow yourself for a buffer. So if, you know, the number of headcount is going to be this, you know, ask yourself, well, what would happen if actually turned out we needed to hire 10%, 20%, 50% more people, or similarly, like 10, 20, or 50% fewer people? What would that do? What would the contingency plans be? Like, where does it break? And what might you be willing to trade off, right? So maybe, you know, maybe you have one extra recruiter, or maybe you have, you know, some extra resources lined up, or, you know, you figure out how resilient is your recruiting plan and organizational capability in response to up or down movement. I think, and that's one of the things that just through kind of failure and different experiences, I think has really been drilled home. You know, during, you know, 2021 and, you know, or, you know, the late 20 teens, it was, you know, always surprising on the upside, right? But then it's like, all right, COVID, and suddenly it's a surprise on the downside, or, you know, the sort of tech slump now, and, you know, lots of teams were surprised on the downside. So I think, you know, that having not only a people strategy and a recruiting strategy, but planning for like resilience and adaptability is really key.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. And I think I heard two other things that obviously are needed to make that work, which is one, having a good understanding of what are your recruiting metrics? How long does it take you to hire someone? I've met with founders who are like, it takes us a year because we want to be really picky. And that might work for some people, but for many companies, that wouldn't work. And then the other piece is having that clear financial understanding and tying back, obviously, the headcount planning to having a clear financial plan, which a lot of early stage companies don't necessarily have great financial planning either, looking ahead. You talked a little bit about today's market. So let's dive into that. In this current environment, people are, you know, there's kind of this tech recession, job recession. People are prioritizing efficiency, execution, maybe going back to one of your old co-founders and kind of getting into that operational rigor. How do you advise companies to kind of create the right incentives through their people strategy in this type of environment?
Yeah. So I think, I mean, I start with kind of three big priorities in kind of the current market. I think companies need to do really well at assessing talent and acting on it, driving alignment and clarity through the whole organization, and building really high performance teams. And all the different kind of tactics and programs, I think, really sort of layer up to one or more of those priorities. I think that compensation has been on a like top of the list for a lot of folks over the past couple of years because of inflation and just how fast it was moving. I think it's something that even as that falls, or actually precisely because that's falling, I think still needs to be really high up there. I think looking at the market data, we are seeing some actual like absolute decline in compensation. And there's a bit of a reset going on. And I think that's happening both in like the top markets, Bay, New York and Seattle, where I actually see new higher compensation falling, you know, especially for some of the tech roles, markedly. But also in other parts of the country. I think that there were a lot of companies that either moved to either explicitly or implicitly location agnostic pay. And I think are finding that that isn't really long-term sustainable, that pay should fundamentally be based on what is the labor market in different locations. And that if you are hiring people across the country or globally, and you are paying everyone at whatever the highest market is, that you're sacrificing like your ability to really hire all of the roles and the full team that you could, because you're overpaying against against local markets. So there's just, I think there's a lot of reset that's going on, and people need to be, companies need to be looking at that in the context of their compensation plans and structure.
Yeah, that's super interesting, that kind of that trade-off, you know, maybe you're paying some people too much and as a result, you can't hire new people that you actually really need on your team. I know you're an advisor for Blind and you've worked on compensation reports. But I wanted to ask, you know, where's good data that people can use to start to learn this stuff? What do you recommend?
Yeah, so I think I'm always a fan of multiple sources of data. And yeah, I'll start with one of the major benchmark surveys, Mercer, Radford, you know, getting broad market data and a full, really, really in-depth across all of the different roles. I'll supplement that in a couple of different places. One is when I'm going to other countries and hiring in other locations, sometimes there are, you know, one survey is better than another and has better local data. And so you want to know that if you're opening up an engineering center in Poland or, you know, wherever it is. Another is then looking at real-time market data. And like the report put out that Blind put out, I thought was really good, like real-time data of what is happening in the market right now. Maybe we can post a link to that. And then it's also working with the recruiting team. It's one of the things that I've always really driven with the recruiting teams that I've led has been getting expectations from candidates. You know, we're tracking compensation for offers, but also candidate expectations. We're looking at how that compares to our ranges and the market data that we're getting. That doesn't mean that every time a manager comes and says, "Oh, our comp is too low," right? That doesn't mean you go and just immediately switch it, but you look at that as another source of data to triangulate where you are.
Yeah, that makes sense, because it's like the most real-time indicator of what candidates are looking for, rather than some of the surveys can end up being a little bit lagging, which I know people have struggled with. You know, when the market takes a turn, it's like, well, how is this past data relevant to today? So
yeah,
that's super helpful. Before we jump into our rapid fire questions here, I only have a couple. Is there anything that you'd want to leave our audience with to kind of close out today, based whether people strategy or hiring advice?
Yeah, I think I would say one of the biggest mistakes that I see is companies just waiting too long to invest into their people team. And they'll wait until they feel the pain of, okay, our comp structure is broken, or okay, we're having all of these challenges with new managers. And then they'll go rush to hire up a people team, and then, you know, it takes a while to put some programs into place. And I think one of the things I've seen with a lot of really successful founders is they've looked ahead and seen what some of those challenges will be and invest ahead on the people team so that they can scale through those stages much more successfully.
I don't even know what to say. That was a great summary, I guess, and helpful for a lot of companies. I'm sure there's a lot of early stage founders listening to this as well. So thank you. And thanks for sharing all your insight and experiences through all these different stages of companies. I like to close out with some rapid fire questions. So not meant to be too serious. What is your favorite interview question to ask candidates?
Oh, my favorite interview question to ask candidates? So I'll hire for a lot of, I'll tell them to give me an example of a problem or a program that they approached in two different companies or circumstances. How did they approach it differently and why? And I ask it to test for strategic thinking and business understanding for the like business partners and strategic HR roles that I hire for, because I want to see, okay, did they really understand the business in two different places and connect that to how it should drive the specific people strategy?
I like that one. I haven't heard anyone say that before. So A lot of times I hear it's something similar. Okay. Next rapid fire question. What is the best purchase you've made this year for less than $100? Bonus points if it's not software, but it can be.
Oh, wow. I think I've gotten really into gardening. And so I just like some little herbs that we've been using, and it's just been, it was a very good like $20 investment on some little herbs. We love it.
I love that. It's sometimes you can find out really interesting things that people are like, I discovered this crazy thing that I got and it was $20. So that's awesome. And final question, just kind of a fun one. What is the next trip you're going on or something that you're excited for coming up?
Oh, I'm headed to Tahoe. We're taking just like a week and a half, and working from an Airbnb out there. And it's been a while since I've been to Tahoe, and it's just, I love it. I'm looking forward to getting out into the woods.
Amazing. I love Tahoe. It's awesome. I've never been in the summer, but the winter is great for skiing, snowboarding. Okay. So thank you for answering my kind of wild off the wall rapid fire questions here. Where can people find you? Where can they learn more about your group at Lattice?
Yeah.
You know, plug yourself.
Come find me on LinkedIn. Just Dave Carhart. Love connecting with folks. Or you can get me at dave@lattice.com.
Awesome. Thank you so much, Dave. It's been a pleasure.
Thanks. Great talking with you.
How We Built Our Team is produced by Dover, a modern suite of tools and services to help you attract and hire top talent. Visit dover.com to learn more. If you enjoyed this episode, consider subscribing on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, or anywhere else you listen to podcasts. See you next time.